I'm Michael Hawes. You're listening to Bobcat Logic. Very thick indeed. Kubla Khan. In Xanadu did Kubla Khan a stately pleasure dome decree, where Alph, the sacred river, ran through caverns measureless to man, down to a sunless sea. So twice 5 miles of fertile ground with walls and towers were girdled round, and there were gardens bright with sinuous rills, where blossomed many an incense-bearing tree, and here were forests ancient as the hills, enfolding sunny spots of greenery. But oh, that deep romantic chasm which slanted down the green hill athwart a cedarn cover! A savage place, as holy and enchanted as e'er beneath a waning moon was haunted by woman wailing for her demon lover. And from this chasm, with ceaseless turmoil seething, as if this earth in fast thick pants were breathing, a mighty fountain momently was forced, amid whose swift half-intermitted burst huge fragments vaulted like rebounding hail, or chaffy grain beneath the thresher's flail. And mid these dancing rocks, at once and ever, it flung up momently the sacred river. 5 miles meandering with a mazy motion through wood and dale the sacred river ran, then reached the caverns measureless to man, and sank in tumult to a lifeless ocean. And mid this tumult Kubla heard from far ancestral voices prophesying war. The shadow of the dome of pleasure floated midway on the waves, where was heard the mingled measure from the fountain and the caves. It was a miracle of rare device, a sunny pleasure dome with caves of ice. A damsel with a dulcimer in a vision once I saw. It was an Abyssinian maid, and on her dulcimer she played, singing of Mount Abora. Could I revive within me her symphony and song, to such a deep delight 'twould win me, that with music loud and long I would build that dome in air, that sunny dome, those caves of ice, and all who heard should see them there, and all should cry, "Beware, beware! His flashing eyes, his floating hair! Weave a circle round him thrice, and close your eyes with holy dread, for he on honeydew hath fed, and drunk the milk of paradise." Samuel Taylor Coleridge. Quote, I say that Auschwitz is an extreme manifestation of an attitude that still thrives in our midst. It shows itself in the treatment of minorities in industrial democracies, in education to a humanitarian point of view included, which most of the time consists of turning wonderful young people into colorless and self-righteous copies of their teachers. It becomes manifest in the nuclear threat, the constant increase in the number and power of deadly weapons, and the readiness of some so-called patriots to start a war compared with which the Holocaust will shrink into insignificance. It shows itself in the killing of nature and of, quote, primitive, unquote, cultures, with never a thought spent on those thus deprived of meaning in their lives, in the colossal deceit of our intellectuals, their belief that they know precisely what humanity needs, and their relentless efforts to recreate people in their own sorry image, in the infantile megalomania of some of our physicians, who blackmail their patients with fear, mutilate them, and then persecute them with large bills, in the lack of feeling of many so-called searchers for truth, who systematically torture animals, study their discomfort, and receive prizes for their cruelty. As far as I am concerned, there exists no difference between the henchmen of Auschwitz and those, quote, benefactors of mankind, unquote. That was a quote from a book called Farewell to Reason, published in 1987 by a man named Paul Feyerabend. Here's my math quiz for the 21st century. X equals infinity minus 1 plus infinity plus 1, where the term infinity minus 1 may be substituted by the poem Kubla Khan by Samuel Taylor Coleridge, and the term infinity plus 1 may be substituted by the quote from Feyerabend. Solve for X. Okay, let's simplify. Infinity plus infinity equals infinity. Thus, infinity equals X. Expressed in words, I would say that we are solving for what came before never and adding it to what came after forever. We should find some very interesting things by way of our inquiries. If we conduct this research in the realms of what we today call history, religion, science, and politics, I venture that we would wind up on what resembles a chessboard constructed from a Möbius strip. Wow! Should we attempt that? By all means. We are humans, so saddle up. The exchequered landscape we shall gallop across is, after all, the very ground we stand our questions on and have our brief experience of life upon. Your roof is also your floor, and your room is the world at large, while the world at large is very surely your room. I have heard that Mr. Coleridge was being visited by some literary friends who suggested a walk. He was feeling poorly due to some medical problems and took some medication, possibly an opiate. He stayed behind in a chair in the garden while the others went for the stroll. The poem he wrote upon waking up from his brief chemical escape from the pain of his existence has now become a classic. When I think of Khan, I think of Genghis, and I think of horses. Open prairie, taiga, tundra, savanna, steppes, llanos, and deserts. Two legs astride four is one of our most ancient symbols for power, triumph, freedom, and mobility. Man and beast combined at first glance. Looked at another way, we may perceive two animals acting together for the benefit of one of them. I cannot see the benefit to the horse in an open grassland setting for making an alliance with man. I could write an entire book on the benefits garnered by the man, up to my own day, by this heavily one-sided partnership. We could canter along behind Genghis and his Mongols to see some of the fruits of this hoofed extension of man's power. We could also stop for 7 days in 732 A.D. at the confluence of the Clain and Vienne rivers between Poitiers and Tours and watch Charles Martel turn back the massive armored cavalry of Emir Abdul Rahman al-Ghafiqi Abd al-Rahman with a vastly smaller infantry force. 4 years later, we could ride over to Narbonne and watch the same Charles Martel crush a further Muslim invasion, this time headed by Rahman's son and arriving by sea. Again, we see Charles using a smaller force, but this time incorporating heavy cavalry with the chainmail and stirrups that his enemy had been equipped with on their first encounter. After watering our mounts, we could ship out to the New World with the Spanish and do some conquering and get the silver and gold mines running at full slave capacity. As we watch this drama, we would see some of these introduced horses become lost or stolen and subsequently become huge roaming herds of wild mustangs ranging north. Several of the tribes in what are today Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, Nevada, and Colorado will go on to utilize these animals both for their own survival and for domination over and expansion of their prairie empires. Their approach to the already well-ingrained old-world methods of domestication and training of the horse will seem uncanny to us as we watch them become one with the caballo. None more than the Comanche tribe as a whole. A newly mounted force of armed men in an economy based upon a migratory food source of behemoth proportions in a harsh environment will evoke a familiar play as we observe them from Kansas to the Gulf of Mexico. Natural selection may be readily observed here, whether one subscribes to Darwin's grandfather's theory via the Royal Academy in toto or not. Like any creature suffering great persecution down through history, it is the superlatives that live to breed. This holds true both for admirable and for dishonorable traits. Aggression, cunning, and what Feyerabend calls, quote, colossal conceit, unquote, and what I might call psychopathy, are as readily passed on as are large hands, tallness, and abundance or lack of body hair. We could watch a small group of Cherokees, for example, who adopted much European clothing, farming practices, writing, religion, and home building, steadily working their way west. They have already intermarried for many, many generations. They are led by a half-Scottish chief who sports freckles and red hair. Some of them are mounted, and they will use their horses to do plowing and land clearing, as well as for transportation. They are seeking a place to be left alone, to practice their hybrid culture, and do not trust waiting to see how it all works out back east. History proves them right in their pessimism and serves up the Cherokee Trail of Tears sometime after their departure. After an earthquake in Missouri compels this group to undertake yet another move farther west, they arrive at what, at the time, was the boundary of civilization as practiced by the United States of America. They are in today's Northeast Texas, which is under the administration of Spain. To their west and to their north are other tribes which are still in their original lands as per their own local history of struggle has allowed. Over time, the Comanches and one band of them in particular, the Quahadis, which was headed by a half-white war chief, Quanah Parker, are the dominant force in this part of the planet. Other tribes are mounted and hostile in the sense of practicing a raiding lifestyle, such as Apache, Cheyenne, Kickapoo, and Arapaho, but all fear and respect the superior Comanche horsemen. The Spanish tolerated them so as to serve as a buffer against any incursion by other colonialists. They were the hands-down pinnacle of mounted fighting men and were only brought to ruin just before getting wide access to the modern repeating firearms of their foes. They stood in the way of the formation of the Republic of Texas, which itself was a stepping stone to the expansion of the USA proper in order to reach the Pacific Ocean and tie both coasts down with rail tracks and barbed wire. As we braid our ponies' tails, we could watch the Cherokee agree to fight the Comanche and Apache so as to free up the Texians to fight the Spanish. Of course, this would net the Cherokee a new, clear title to their extensive holdings that would replace the valid title they had obtained legally from the Spanish government in Mexico City in accordance to the Euro way of doing things. They smelled the wind, and they picked a horse. A considered bet was placed, much like Eudes, the great Duke Odo of Aquitaine, did in 730 when he allied himself to Uthman ibn Naissa, the emir of Catalonia. He had defeated a Muslim invasion force at Toulouse in 721 and then had watched the invaders reach Burgundy 4 years later. He picked a horse, and his horse picked a fight with Abd Rahman, emir of Al-Andalus, who has already been mentioned in this essay. The source, www.thelatinlibrary.com/imperialism/notes/tours.html, accessed January 11, 2016, tells us, quote, "According to one unidentified Arab, that army went through all places like a desolating storm. Duke Eudes, called king by some, collected his army at Bordeaux, but was defeated, and Bordeaux was plundered. The slaughter of Christians at the River Garonne was evidently horrific. Isidorus Pacensis commented that Solus Deus numerum morientium vel periuntium recognoscat. God alone knows the number of the slain. Chronicon." The Muslim horsemen then utterly devastated that portion of Gaul, their own history saying, "The faithful pierced through the mountains, trampled over rough and level ground, plundered far into the country of the Franks, and smote all with the sword, insomuch that when Eudo came to battle with them at the River Garonne, and fled. Eudes appealed to the Franks for assistance, which Charles Martel only granted after Eudes agreed to submit to Frankish authority." Unquote. Yes, the Duke did change horses in the middle of a stream. He kept his hide, but he had to give up his separate kingdom and be subsumed into greater Frankdom. The Texas Cherokees picked a horse and went to war allied with the Texians. Soon afterward, as their land titles sat unratified on the president's desk of the new one republic, they were approached and given notice that the document had been rejected and nullified. They were asked to leave their crops, houses, and farms and head to reservations. They chose to fight after much consultation with all involved and lost the ensuing Battle of the Natchez. They picked the wrong horse and rode it over the edge. Some painted their horses and survived extermination. We spur our mounts and head back home to 2016 and our flat screens. On the way, we see a stray lone wolf begging food at the mouth of a cave from a man. A prince loosing a falcon and a pharaoh setting a jaguar onto a fleeing gazelle. Once home, we see Muslim turmoil again in France and Germany. We see Catalonia separating from Spain. We see yet another Trail of Tears. We see charter schools teaching the Quran and Sharia law in the USA. We see a businessman in Nevada with an exclusive license to send weapons into space via his own private company. We are urged to worry about a millimeter rise in ocean levels, as if every man, woman, and child on Earth had a waterfront beach home to be concerned with. We are compelled to trade 10 serious side effects for a 50-50 shot at eradicating temporarily a single symptom, all the while leaving our malaise unhealed. We see an ex-CIA drug operative thrown to the wolves during an election year after being purposely empowered for years. We stop and check if we are indeed home again in our own time and confirm that this is indeed the case. We read that many top scientists and philosophers of science have been of the opinion for over 2 decades that there is nothing of any material benefit to humanity left to be discovered. As we munch on a chemical-laden biscuit, reading an article about a cougar recently shot in Idaho, which had an entire set of fangs growing out of the top of its head facing backwards, and watch the good old nuclear-capable B-52s winging their way back to South Korea, we wonder why our houses are chilly, why our food is substandard, why our water is laden with detrimental additives, and why our children are unable to afford even the extremely substandard, politically correct brainwashing for social change that masquerades as post-secondary education. We do a quick check back to the 18th century and realize that, yes, taken as a whole, we have become very thick indeed. All the benefits and comforts afforded us by science are priced out of our reach while we are simultaneously harangued by those who can afford them to provide these things to everybody on the planet at our own expense, except those countries our leaders are currently engaged in destroying. The daylight tax of old has morphed into the carbon tax. We return our horses to their former wild state, and they carry on just fine without our ministrations on their behalf. Our dogs sit at our feet awaiting our orders while our cats keep one eye on the fridge and another on the door. We ponder that the real water crisis is about how much of it has been converted to ethanol and soda pop since the beginning. We ponder that every alliance eventually unravels like an old sweater, and that betting on horses is just that, betting. A 50-50 shot when measured over time on the Mobius strip that is our human story. If something works, it is not abandoned. Power is never given away for free. In terms of actual, factual intelligence, via the Freedom of Information Act and such like, history has a depth of less than 50 years and is constantly being rewritten. According to the telly, it appears that Hitler made it out of the bunker and traveled from Argentina to Colombia. We ponder a quote which was learned by Prince Henry from his chosen tutor, Sir Walter Raleigh, as that condemned man awaited execution in the Tower of London by order of Henry's father, James, an order fueled in part by jealousy due to Raleigh's writing of a history of the world and dedicating that work to a sensible young Henry. Quote, "All wars of religion are only civil wars, and by civil war no nation's condition was ever bettered." End quote. Henry, Prince of Wales, circa 1618. As I light my smoke and blow my prayer skyward in the figure eight, I wonder, who bet on Rowley's horse?
A thousand miles of coming. Yes, I've worn blisters on my heels, trying to find me something better. Here on on the streets of Bakersfield. Hey, you don't know me, but you don't like me. Say you care less how I feel. But how many of you that sit and judge me ever walk the streets of Bakersfield? San Francisco, I spent a night there in the can. They threw this drunk man in my jail cell. I took $15 from that man. Left him my watch and my old house key. Don't want folks thinking that I'd steal. Then I thanked him as I was leaving. I headed out for Bakersfield. Hey, you don't know me, but you don't like me. Say you care less how I feel. But how many of you that sit and judge me ever walk the streets of Bakersfield? Hey, you don't know me, but you don't like me. Say you care less. Bakersfield. How many of you sitting and judge me ever walk the streets of Bakersfield?
Come on, Zigzag. Looks like rain.